From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest will be Ken Libertoff, who will be discussing the difficulties patients with mental illness have in accessing medical care due to poor insurance coverage. And then later in the show, in our opinion segment, Victor Seidel, former president of the American Public Health Association, will be joining us to discuss the public health implications of the Bush administration's Iraq policy. But first, an update from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The U.S. Census Bureau reported that the number of Americans with no form of health insurance rose by 1.4 million between the year 2000 and 2001. About 8.5 million of the uninsured were children. The number and percentage of people covered by government health programs also rose dramatically during the period. Enrollment in the Medicaid program alone increased by 2 million. The Medicaid program covers the poor and disabled. Given the significant decline in the percentage of the population covered by employment-based private health insurance during this period, had enrollment in government programs not increased, the number of uninsured Americans would have been much higher. Young adults aged 18 to 24 remain the least likely of any age group to have health insurance in 2001. Over 28% of this age group had no insurance coverage. The New England and North Central states had the lowest percentage of uninsured at around 7%. On the other hand, Texas and New Mexico had the highest proportion of their populations uninsured. Over 23% of the populations of Texas and New Mexico have no form of health insurance. The greatest decline in insurance coverage occurred among small businesses. In an effort to address the increasing numbers of uninsured in Vermont, over 500 people braved the final rains of Hurricane Isidore to attend a rally for a statewide program of health, universal health care. The rally took place September 28th. The crowd heard from doctors, nurses, mental health workers, and even a 94-year-old woman who has fought for universal health care for much of her life and vowed that we would achieve it during her lifetime. The keynote speaker at the rally was Quentin Young.
I argue that the health care issue is by definition the largest social justice issue in this country. It affects everyone. If not me, my family. If not my family, my neighbor. If not my neighbor, my community. Sometime. It's huge. It's 1/7 of the whole gross domestic product dedicated to costs of health care. Twice as much, as you probably know, as the next nations to us. With that kind of money, we could have the best health care system in the world and the suffering and fear that's associated with health care. Let doctors be doctors again. Let me plead with you, keep this fight up. The biggest pleasure I get is all these different politicians, different persuasion, hoping to win your favor. Tell them you got it if you vote for health insurance for all. Thank you.
Rally organizers hope to maintain the crowd's energy and demand that every legislator take a public position on the issue and that voters will be impacted by the stand their legislators take. Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson approved a waiver that will allow New York to extend Medicaid coverage to uninsured women diagnosed with breast or cervical cancer through the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program, which is administered by the CDC. New York tests about 60,000 women for these cancers each year under the program, and state officials estimate that about 500 of these women will test positive each year and thereby qualify for the new program. New York is the 45th state to receive the waiver. Women who qualify will receive Medicaid coverage throughout their cancer treatment, but it will not cover other health problems these women may encounter, so they will still lack insurance coverage for other health problems ranging from all other forms of cancer to high blood pressure treatment or even for insulin if they suffer from diabetes. the one major Bush administration initiative to provide coverage to the uninsured is a regulation that will allow states to define fetuses as unborn children eligible for health coverage under the Children's Health Insurance Program. This regulation marks the first time that any federal policy has defined childhood as beginning at conception. The CHIP program currently provides government-funded health insurance to low-income children from birth to age 19 in families with annual incomes too high to allow them to qualify for Medicaid. Secretary Thompson said that the regulation would increase the number of low-income women who receive prenatal care, but administration critics called the new rule a backdoor effort to promote an anti-abortion agenda and establish a legal precedent that recognizes fetuses as people, and that if the administration had simply desired to expand coverage to more pregnant women, it could simply have taken that step. Having expanded prenatal care as oriented toward the fetus, any medical care not directly related to the well-being of the fetus will be excluded from coverage in the program that Thompson announced. During the month of September, the state of California enacted five laws of major significance to the public health. First, ignoring the Bush administration position that no federal money would be provided to support embryonic stem cell research, the state of California enacted a law that promises state money to fund such research. The use of embryonic stem cells is one of the few promising lines of research that may lead to effective treatments for many degenerative diseases, including the common neurological disorders, Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's disease. Abortion opponents fought the legislation, both because stem cells would be obtained by interfering with the natural process of pregnancy and because they view the fertilized egg as a human being that should not be sacrificed. But support for the bill came from most Democrats, and many Republicans also supported it, encouraged by the intense lobbying effort of Nancy Reagan. Since former President Reagan announced that he was afflicted by Alzheimer's disease, his wife has been a strong public advocate for embryonic stem cell research. The remaining four pieces of legislation enacted in California relate to women's reproductive rights. First, the state of California is now requiring that all OBGYN residency programs provide training in all commonly used outpatient procedures, including elective abortion. No individuals or hospitals are required to participate if they view abortion as being morally objectionable. The Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, which supervises all residency training programs, requires OBGYN programs to teach abortion procedures to residents, but more than half of the programs nationwide do not adhere to this requirement, and there are significant disparities in the quality among those that do. The second law requires healthcare workers to provide emergency contraception for all rape survivors. A third bill mandates that the state shall not interfere with a woman's fundamental right to choose to bear a child or to choose to obtain an abortion. This law strengthens California's existing abortion laws by ensuring access to legal abortions in the event that the U.S. Supreme Court overturns the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion nationwide. The final California measure protects the confidentiality and safety of abortion clinic workers, volunteers, and patients by allowing them to enroll in the state's Safe at Home program. Women's rights supporters see the new laws as an important advance for women in California and a model for the nation as a whole. Our final report concerns a guest who appeared on Public Health Radio earlier this year. Janine Jagger from the University of Virginia has been awarded an unrestricted MacArthur Fellowship. This honor provides generous, unrestricted funds for a 5-year period. Her award received nationwide attention when this year's award recipients were interviewed on ABC News Nightline program. Dr. Jagger intends to use the award to further her work to protect healthcare workers in the Global South from bloodborne diseases resulting from needle stick injuries and other dangerous exposures. Coming up next, we'll examine health insurance coverage for mental illness. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In the United States, private health insurance companies have traditionally had the right to define benefit packages as they wish, including the magnitude of copayments, deductibles, maximum lifetime benefits, and also what services might be excluded from coverage altogether. Throughout the United States, private insurance coverage for mental health conditions has been limited and far narrower than has been the case for physical illness. For decades, advocates for individuals suffering from mental illnesses have pushed for parity in coverage, meaning that each insurance company would be obliged to make their coverage of mental illnesses equivalent to their coverage for physical ailments. The parity movement received a boost 3 months ago when President Bush took a public position favoring parity, and a groundbreaking parity bill has passed the United States Senate. Our guest today is Ken Libertoff. Dr. Libertoff received his training in clinical psychology at Harvard University, and he's been executive director of the Vermont Association for Mental Health since 1981. In that capacity, he has been a tireless advocate for improving the treatment of mental illness in the state of Vermont. And in today's interview, he will describe the success Vermont has had in this area, in no small part due to his efforts and the work of others in his organization. He has won numerous awards and honors for his mental health advocacy work. Dr. Libertoff, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Well, glad to be with you.
Within the medical community, the field of mental health is sometimes viewed like a poor stepchild, and in this kind of view, a surgeon does a heroic thing, takes out an aneurysm, while a psychiatrist might just be treating someone who's sad, and that's not considered as dramatic or heroic. And, of course, in the community, mental illness is often viewed the same way. Why don't they just buck up and deal with things? I have had trouble in my life. I dealt with it. What's your problem? So I think, in my view at least, the discrimination against individuals who suffer from mental illness in the society generally, and probably in the insurance system, might derive from attitudes like these. Is that your perception?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's fair to say that one of the major issues confronting our society today when it comes to the adequate treatment of mental health problems is that there is a good deal of discrimination and stigma still attached to this disease. And I think, as you suggested, one of the places where it's frankly most evident is within the insurance industry. And the results of this, of course, have been studied, and there's just no question that in the end, discrimination and stigma reduces Vermonters, the people who live in New York State, it reduces their access to treatment and care and to other auxiliary services that they may need, whether it relates to housing or jobs. And even more poignant, it creates and has created, in some ways, a cruel and vicious cycle, because it creates more isolation and hopelessness and a lowering of self-esteem, which we all would know is an important part of regaining one's health. And certainly, from the point of view of my work in the last 20 years or so with the Vermont Association for Mental Health, one of the things that I have seen is that discrimination and stigma really deprives people of their dignity. And when that happens, nothing good results.
Now, when I reviewed your CV, it's obvious that you fought for years to improve the quality of care provided to patients who suffer from mental illness. And I know that you've done so not merely because the illnesses are common, but also because they're treatable. And I guess overall I'd like to hear your view of the effectiveness of mental illnesses compared to, say, illnesses such as arthritis or stroke or cancer, for instance.
Well, I think it's a very good question, and I think that it's fair to say that there have been many changes and, frankly, amazing improvements in the effectiveness of treatment in mental health. And this is combined between therapeutic approaches and pharmaceutical approaches. The use of new drugs and medications combined have had an astounding improvement. The fact of the matter is that there are more similarities than differences, and that's what we're finding in some of the research. Living and working in a small state like Vermont, it's incredibly exciting to actually know people who 20 years ago would be absolutely debilitated and perhaps institutionalized in our major state hospital, to run into them at the gas station or to see them shopping on their own in the grocery store, and to see them leaving at the end of a day's work at 4:30 is testimony to the incredible changes that are taking place. In Vermont, just to give you an example, 40 years or so ago, we had well over 1,000 people in any one day at our state hospital. And that went on for years and years. Today, the average census number is down to 50, which is an indication that we have much more effective treatment. We have much more effective ways of providing community-based services. So there's incredible breakthroughs on the more serious mental health disorders, the brain disorders, the schizophrenia and bipolar.
Well, I'd like to focus now on the care that's provided to patients suffering from mental illness, and maybe starting out with insurance coverage and how that works for or not so well for these individuals. And I assume that just as is the case for health insurance generally, that there probably are the same, that most of the people are going to fall within three groups: those with private insurance, those insured through one of the public systems, and then people who have no insurance coverage at all.
That's right.
So I was wondering if you could maybe start with the first group, and how have people who have health insurance, private health insurance, fared in accessing treatment?
Well, I'll do the best I can. It's a fairly comprehensive question, and I think I can certainly give you outlines that are useful. The first thing that I would say is that in most states in the United States, there is an absolute discriminatory practice by most insurance companies and the insurance industry in covering mental illnesses. So for a person who might be listening to this particular program, particularly if you live outside Vermont, and we'll come back to that later, if you have a card in your wallet or near your person that is your card of coverage, the one thing that it doesn't say very clearly is that you may have $1 million of coverage for any kind of physical problem that you may have. What the card probably doesn't say is that you are limited in your lifetime by how much mental health coverage you can have. In Vermont, as outrageous as it seems now, up until 1997, no matter how much you wanted to pay, the best policy that you can get only covered up to $10,000 lifetime. And I think it's very, one would not be shocked to hear that if you or your son or daughter, wife or spouse or mother, next-door neighbor had a serious mental health illness, you would very quickly approach a lifetime limit if you had to be hospitalized. And this is the exact wrong approach, because insurance supposedly is designed to help really cover the catastrophe in your life. That's why very much we all want to have insurance. So that's a fundamental problem. It's particularly acute for everybody in New York State right now, because New York State has made very limited progress despite sort of valiant efforts on the part of a number of state leaders, both in the legislature and advocates in the state, to create a much more fair and equal insurance law, what we're calling the parity approach, which is equalizing treatment for physical health care with mental health care. But the insurance companies have often designed mental health benefits in a way that creates some other barriers for accessing care. And I don't want to belabor it too long, but I do want people, and I do want you to know, that one of the ways they do that is by having higher deductibles and copayments for mental health treatment than for physical health care. And so for many of us, if a son or daughter has some kind of physical health problem, we know that it's a $15 copayment if one goes to see a doctor. Well, if that same copayment is $50 or $100, from our point of view, one of the things it does is greatly discourages accessing care, because that's a much larger sum, and for a lot of people, it's an absolute barrier. So having these different limits on copayments and deductibles is an approach which has been very, very detrimental, besides the lifetime limit, which is actually a disaster for many families who are in jeopardy. Almost everybody's in jeopardy if you have a very low lifetime limit for mental health coverage. So that has been what is still very prevalent in most of the United States.
Before we get to the efforts to reform, I actually just wanted to focus back on the types of obstacles in coverage by the private health insurance industry. You mentioned the importance of lifetime limits and deductibles and copayments, but one of the things that I had some very good friends when I lived in upstate New York who were in the mental health field, and they would constantly talk about the reams of documentation, extra hours they had to spend at work pleading with the behavioral managed care companies to approve a patient to get a couple more counseling sessions approved. And it was a real big problem for people with fairly serious mental health problems. They were constantly begging to get a few more sessions approved. Kind of, and they felt like they were being nickeled and dimed for somebody with a very significant health problem. And I'm wondering if that type of mechanism has been common.
Well, it has been very common, but I would caution you and others to also keep in mind that whether we live in New York State or Vermont, we also certainly operate within the United States. And the United States has not been able to really come to grips with redesigning a healthcare system that might make more sense. And when I say that, I have to tell you that if you talk to any physician today, and now we're not dealing with mental health at all, they would probably complain almost as much as the mental health practitioners that you allude to, who you know in upstate New York. So we do have a profound crisis at the moment in that most states, and the United States, has adopted a model of what's been called managed care, which in the eyes of many national leaders now has lost a good deal of its luster. The concept makes sense. The design was certainly to more tightly manage the flow of dollars and access to treatment. I think most people who have observed its actual impact have been greatly disappointed, partly for the reason that you have mentioned, that is that it has created an incredible morass of paperwork, of regulation, and frankly, there have often been incentives written into managed care contracts that reward managed care companies for reducing the amount of money that goes into healthcare. And I'm not sure that's really the kind of healthcare system that many of the listeners want to have, particularly if it relates to themselves or their parents. We don't want people making decisions when there are financial incentives to keep people from accessing care. In mental health, though, it's particularly acute, as you said, because managed care companies have tried, I'd say for the most part very unsuccessfully, to regulate and manage the access to treatment.
Now, you started to talk about the reform that was made to move toward parity, meaning comparable quality of coverage for mental health problems as compared to physical health problems.
That's right.
And the progress that's been made in Vermont. And I was wondering if you want to describe that in a little more detail, or and then maybe compare it to New York State or the nation, other
Sure.
states in the nation as a whole.
I could try to do that. I will simply say that in 1997, our legislature entertained a comprehensive parity bill that actually covers not only mental health treatment but all substance abuse treatment. And after a very, very vigorous and oftentimes contentious debate in the legislature, the House of Representatives and then the Senate approved a bill which is landmark legislation. And in short, what the bill basically says is that all policies sold in the state of Vermont must include, it's mandated, it must include this equity for mental health treatment and for substance abuse. This is just an enormous barrier that has been broken just by taking that position. The second thing that the bill said was that your lifetime coverage has to be equal, which is very, very important. As I said earlier, I had countless interviews with families in prior years who, through no fault of their own, it could have been cancer, it could have been heart disease. Tragically, for the individual who was visiting me or for a child, their child, they happened to come down with the disease of mental illness, and they had gone over their $10,000 limit. And what they were facing was not only a major health problem, but they're facing a disastrous economic crisis in the family. But to go on further with our bill, what we basically have said, you must have equal copayments and equal deductibles. So just to give you an example, I mean, in early January of 1998, very early in the year, I received a call from a mother whose daughter had actually exceeded her lifetime cap at age 15 because she had a serious mental health problem, and almost, it was almost a suicide in the family, and the daughter was in treatment in a residential program and was getting good treatment, but when she reached the year prior her $10,000 limit, she received a letter from, in this case, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont, saying you have to start paying out of pocket. We all know that there's very few families in either Vermont or New York who can pay out of pocket for a hospitalization for something as serious as a major mental depression, or, for that matter, major cancer treatments. So when this mother called me, she had heard about our parity bill on the 6 o'clock television news and wanted to know whether this really had any impact, whether this comprehensive parity law for mental health that was now in effect starting the 1st of January would make any difference in ending what I would consider the arbitrary discriminatory practices. And very happily, I could tell her that, yes, this was a new era and a new period of history in the United States, because the Vermont bill, in fact, is now the national model. And I think many people would probably understand when I say just passing a bill does not automatically mean that everything falls into place. But we have made profound progress in equalizing access to treatment, in my opinion, when a person has a mental health problem and has insurance in the private marketplace. We have destroyed a number of the serious barriers that exist in states like New York.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. Our guest is Ken Libertoff. We've been discussing the struggle to improve insurance coverage for individuals suffering from mental illness. After the break, we'll be discussing the status of national parity legislation and also the mental health system available to those who don't have private health insurance coverage. Then, later in the show, an analysis of the Bush administration's Iraq policy from past president of the American Public Health Association. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest today is Ken Libertoff, clinical psychologist and executive director of the Vermont Association for Mental Health. We've been discussing the many struggles of individuals suffering from mental illness. One of their major struggles is to obtain adequate insurance coverage that will actually provide them the care they need. In the first part of our interview, Dr. Libertoff described the successful movement for mental health parity in the state of Vermont and a handful of other states. I know that advocates have also been working at the federal level, but before we get to that, wasn't there some progress in this area just recently for employees of the federal government?
early in January of 2001, President Clinton actually was able to provide the kind of parity approach that the state of Vermont has taken. And right now, as we talk, approximately 9 million federal employees do have a parity coverage for mental health and substance abuse, which is, in our opinion, just a terrific advancement. So what we're seeing is very definite incremental improvements, but it certainly has been a battle in individual states, and New York State in particular has at least entertained a variety of bills over the last few years, but they have not successfully passed yet, and we hope they will.
And only a total of 6 or 7 states across the country have accomplished what Vermont has.
Well, I'd say that I don't want to sound too parochial, even though folks here in Vermont are very proud of their state. I would say that 4 or 5 states have come close to approaching the comprehensiveness of our bill, and I think that that's great. But it's a slight embarrassment to say that our bill passed in 1997, and we still are considered the national model in the United States in 2002. You would have hoped that we would no longer be the national model.
What you pointed out, that the state of Vermont required all private insurers who operate in the state to comply with a parity law, and you also point out that President Clinton allowed that same right for federal employees.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal government could do what Vermont did for all the private insurance companies that operate in the whole country.
That
would be a bigger step.
That's right.
And I guess you wanted to talk about whether you think that might be happening. And one of the remarkable things is that the health insurance industry, of course, contributes very, very heavily to Republicans, and they've always opposed mandates such as parity for mental health. So for years, many Democrats, Paul Wellstone, Hillary Clinton, and others, have supported parity. But recently, Domenici, a senator from New Mexico, who's fairly influential, and the president himself have made public statements in support of requiring parity. And I'm wondering if you feel optimistic now about the possibility of reform coming from the federal government.
Well, I think there is reason for tempered optimism. The reason that Senator Domenici, you referred to, who is a very powerful and well-respected senator from the state of New Mexico, one of the more powerful Republicans, and frankly one of the more conservative Republicans, the reason that he became such a champion of this is because his daughter has come down with one of those serious illnesses that I talked about earlier, and although it was very painful, enormously painful, as it is for any parent to experience this, firsthand in his own life and his own family, he began to see what the devastating impact was of having all the barriers which we've been talking about and which you have correctly started with in your analysis. He could see those firsthand. Politically, he was not a proponent of mandation. He certainly wasn't necessarily a proponent of expanding health care coverage. But as tens of thousands of Americans, mental illness doesn't discriminate in a sense. It affects Republicans, it affects Democrats, and it certainly affects both the very rich and the very poor and those in between. I think President Bush is another excellent example where in a fairly well-publicized series of news reports and articles, it's become very apparent that the Bush family knows firsthand some of the difficulty around substance abuse problems. As I said before, in our parity bill, very clearly, mental health and substance abuse are included because the two are so intermingled and both need treatment.
So overall, you're feeling optimistic about the possibility of reform coming from the federal government?
Well, the federal bill is right now stalled in the House of Representatives. When the president, who visited New Mexico a number of months ago, gave a superb speech on the need and importance of having parity, it certainly was very well received by proponent bill. However, the lobbyists for the business in particular and the insurance industry are fighting very hard against the bill. And it's one of those bills that is now, frankly, sitting on a fence in the United States House of Representatives.
So far, this discussion, we've been talking about the private health insurance industry, and the 62% or so of the percent of the U.S. population that has coverage through the private sector. So I guess I'd like to now turn to the other two groups. One would be people insured through the public sector, but perhaps before we do that, over 40 million people in the country have no form of health insurance whatever. Presumably some of them suffer from mental illness, quite likely. Do you know how they do generally in accessing care?
Well, it's first of all a major, major problem in the United States today, no matter what state you're in. And in some ways, those people without insurance and those people who depend on federal programs both face many of the same barriers. My own analysis is that of all the illnesses that we could think of, mental illness is such an awful example of the failure of the private insurance industry to cover this problem. So it has created a massive number of people who depend on the federal government to have any access to health care. And I guess the analogy here would be if people who had heart conditions or cancer conditions really had terrible coverage, we would have some type of federal program set up, but they would never be able to come anywhere where needing the needs. So here in Vermont, we've taken great pride in building a public community mental health system that we think is very good. As a matter of fact, 7 or 8 years ago in a national study, our system was rated the best in the country. And I remember I was interviewed on a radio program that same day in the State House. And I wasn't trying to be either bittersweet or cynical, but I said, my God, if we're the number one public mental health system serving primarily people with no insurance or depending on some type of federal assistance, I can only imagine how bad the rest of America must be. However, as I said before, it's almost impossible to have adequate funding for that system, partly because of the stigma that's associated with the disease and with our present condition, which is in most states, private mental health insurance is terrible. The coverage is terrible. So people, in fact, are pushed into the public system. And this is not a disaster waiting to happen. This is a disaster that has happened. And as a person who works in the field, I know there was a terribly poignant article about problems in New York City in the public system. And it's all very predictable. We cannot adequately treat the vast numbers of people in this country who don't have insurance and simply treat them, in public systems that are underfunded. And frankly, many people have to go into the public system because they don't have adequate private health insurance, even though their families are eligible to have private insurance, but if it has limitations of $10,000 lifetime or $100 copay every time they need to go, or other types of discriminatory practices, they will be pushed into the public system, but it simply doesn't work.
And the way that works is that if the mental illness is severe enough, they can go through a disability evaluation to determine if their mental illness create significant disability, then that would presumably qualify them for public money.
That's right.
And then the private insurance company's off the hook.
That's right. That's right. But the private insurance company is off the hook if they've met their minimum standards, which in our state, and I can talk better about our state, there were many, many cases that I documented, and it had a profound impact in our legislature of, in this case, particularly teenagers who had serious mental illness. And everybody, certainly, we all know that there's a great deal of societal concern about wanting to help younger people. But we had many situations where young teenagers were getting excellent treatment up until the day they hit their $10,000 lifetime limit. And basically, it was like an immediate disconnect. And that was the end of the access to treatment. And it takes months and months to go through a process to be as you, you know, described, identified as a person eligible for a public program during that interim time, very often bad things happen. But even when one is found eligible, because of the budget cuts, particularly right now in Vermont and in New York State and around the country, the public systems that we're talking about are reeling under, you know, terrible, terrible economic pressures. And I know in Vermont, and I'm sure in New York State too, the talk is only about reducing coverage and programs in the public sector. So it is a profoundly major problem at this moment.
You've worked so hard to create parity for health for the private health insurance system, and you have in Vermont, we've succeeded thanks to the effort of you and other people in your organization, and we may be moving along at the federal level. Other states are coming on board at the same, so we may be seeing gradual improvements in access to mental health care for people who are insured through the private health insurance system. I'm just wondering if, at the same time as we may be seeing improvements in that sector, if we're going to see a widening gap between the relatively wealthy segments of the population who have access to private health insurance and those who are forced into the public system, where we're seeing more and more cutbacks, if there's going to be more of a hiatus between the quality of care in those two groups.
Well, I think, first of all, I think your analysis is correct. I think when it comes to health care, to some degree, you've described the American way, which is wealthier people have access to much better health care, and they have much better access to that much better health care. There are a couple of ways of addressing that issue, in my opinion. And certainly one way is for there to be parity bills around the country that are comprehensive, that cover all conditions and create an equal playing field for those people who get their insurance through work and generally represent citizens who are in a better economic state. The other issue is there are people in Congress, and we've tried in Vermont with only limited success so far, but we're not giving up, to create language that would require more parity in the Medicaid and Medicare plans in the federal government. Senator Jim Jeffords has actually been outstanding on this issue. And until you do both, you do have a number of very serious problems, as you alluded to. Compounding that is the fact that there are very few people in America today that are satisfied with our general system for healthcare, whether it be the public sector or the private sector. And so the issue is certainly one that will be a major, major issue, not only a clinical issue of best practices, but a political issue for the next two decades as we try to sort out various and different models, whether it be the single-payer model, whether it be a total restructuring of our Medicaid, Medicare systems, along with mandated bills like parity. But these are major long-term solutions, and it's very difficult for all of us, whether you be a practitioner and your experience, whether you be an advocate, whether you be a family member or an individual who's trying to get access for this treatment. Our current situation leaves a lot to be desired.
What kinds of actions might concerned listeners do to promote better access to care for patients with mental illness?
Well, that's a fairly broad question, but I would say, first of all, that making sure that there's an awareness about the importance of passing parity legislation is certainly a major priority, and I would say particularly in New York State, this should be an important high priority for anyone who is concerned about improving mental health treatment. And again, I think the Mental Health Association in Albany is a good contact, and not unlike our effort here, it certainly is an effort that needs the partnership of many important groups and many important players. And that's a good place to start. That can be done right away. I also think that there's no question that people who are interested need to let members of Congress know that at this very moment, there is a federal parity bill that is being discussed.
Can you tell us of some websites where interested listeners could obtain more information?
Well, the one that I would recommend, frankly, is the website for the Vermont Association for Mental Health, because many of the issues that we've been talking about are listed and then connected, so that if people wanted to get more information on the federal parity bill, they could. If they wanted to hear more about regulating managed care companies, they could find that information. And certainly if they wanted to better understand the construction of our parity legislation, they could do that, as well as find access then to other regional and national groups. So our website is www.vamh.org.
Well, Ken Libertoff, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, and I can only say that this is an issue worth discussing and debating. It's too important a healthcare matter to allow other people to control its destiny. We need to make improvements.
You're listening to Public Health Radio. Coming up next, Nobel Prize-winning public health advocate analyzed the Bush administration's Iraq policy.
I can't be happy for being blue when you keep on worrying.
This is Public Health Radio. Our guest for the opinion segment on today's show is Victor Seidel, the distinguished university professor of social medicine at Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's the past president of the American Public Health Association and helped to found the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the organization that was awarded the 1985 Nobel Prize for Peace. Victor Seidel, welcome to Public Health Radio.
I'm glad to be with you.
Your organization won the Nobel Prize for its work to analyze and combat the threat of nuclear war.
That's correct.
And in so you've been thinking about the nuclear threat for years, which in each part of the world may manifest in different ways. My analysis of the Iraq situation is that the primary question about whether Iraq is a danger centers around whether Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, is a nuclear danger. And when you're looking at the nuclear threats that exist in the world today, does Iraq pop up as the one that concerns you the most among the many that may exist? What's your analysis of the overall nuclear threat to the world?
The nuclear threat to the world exists in a number of nations that not only clearly have nuclear weapons, but have tested them. We know specifically where those weapons are. The list is led by the United States and Russia, which inherited the weapons from the Soviet Union. It includes Great Britain, France, and China, all of whom clearly have nuclear weapons and have tested them. India and Pakistan have tested nuclear weapons in recent years, have smaller, much smaller numbers of nuclear weapons, and it is alleged, fairly strongly alleged, that Israel has nuclear weapons, but unlike the other countries that we've listed, it has not acknowledged possessing nuclear weapons. Those are the main nations that are the main threats for the causation of nuclear war in the world.
Those nations possess nuclear weapons, but that doesn't mean that they're a threat. So if you take those nations that possess nuclear weapons and then say, well, which of those might actually use them irrationally or whatever, which, again, does Iraq, from your point of view, the nation that you worry about the most, unleashing a nuclear holocaust?
Not, by far not. Though nations that I think they're the greatest threat for unleashing nuclear weapons are India and Pakistan, which might use them against each other. I think Israel has indicated, has threatened, but not explicitly, that if it is attacked by biological or chemical weapons, that it might retaliate with nuclear weapons. And I think the other nation that poses a threat at the moment is the United States, because the United States has threatened to use nuclear weapons on a number of occasions. It's the only nation in the world that has used nuclear weapons in war in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and is also planning to build, has actually built, what are called earth-penetrating weapons, bunker buster bombs that are based on nuclear weapons. So I would say the danger of what nuclear weapons use in order is India, Pakistan, Israel, and the United States.
Does Iraq appear on your list at all? Do you?
Nope, because there is no evidence that Iraq at the moment has the fissile materials, the plutonium or the uranium, that are needed to produce an atomic weapon. The technology, the way to use the fissile material, is fairly well known. Many nations have that technology or know that technology, but we have no evidence that Iraq currently has the fissile materials needed to produce the weapon.
Is it possible that an international regime of weapons inspections and other types of systems to prevent Iraq from obtaining those materials, are they likely to be effective?
Sure. If there were inspections on the territory and they had reasonably free access to the sites at which the weapons might be produced, the presence of those weapon inspections would be a strong deterrent to having those weapons produced.
If people accept the notion that it's acceptable for the United States to embark on preventive wars, don't you feel that that might motivate other nations that feel that there might be a threat in the future, that it might encourage those nations to also embark on preventive wars of their own?
That's, of course, a great danger. I mean, there have been lots of examples. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, that was an attempt to prevent the United States from its economic embargo against Japan. They felt that they had justification to attack the United States, and therefore Pearl Harbor was bombed. When Germany invaded countries prior to the start of World War II, they gave as justification the oppression of Germans in those other countries. They felt that preventive war and attack on other countries was justified. The rest of the world, of course, did not. So if the United States now embarks on a preventive attack, preemptive attack, or other kind of attack on other nations, that sets a precedent which other nations could use.
So how do you think a policy on preventive military intervention, what should that policy look like? It sounds like you don't support it as Bush is currently proposing it.
The United Nations Charter makes clear that when a nation is in imminent danger of attack, that it may indeed prevent that attack or attack first when that is absolutely necessary. That's written into the United Nations Charter. But the situation now, of course, has nothing to do with that. Iraq is in no position to attack the United States. It is not at all clear that Iraq is in possession of nuclear weapons. So this is not a situation in which a preemptive strike is legal or necessary or proper.
What are the public health effects that we're likely to see if we do embark on a military venture in Iraq?
Well, as Barry Levy and I have pointed out in our book, A War in Public Health, there are many, many consequences to the public health of war and preparation for war. Obviously, the most important is the lives that are lost in the military action on both sides. A second consequence of war are the creation of refugees, both internal and external, to the country. A third problem that war creates for public health is the diversion of resources. Resources that could have been used for public health have gone to preparation for war and for the war itself. And there are a number of other, which we can go down if we have time, of the consequences to a nation that is engaged in war and at the same time has health needs within its own country.
Now, So the ultimate conclusion is that you are opposed to the Bush policy and would want a different policy instead.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the Bush policy, which indeed was combating terrorism, and I think trying to find ways to prevent terrorism is an extraordinarily important task for the United States. But that effort to work on terrorism has been pushed aside in favor of a debate on attacking Iraq, and that, I think, is a problem for the United States, is a false move for the United States.
I'd like to ask you one last question. The many countries in the world, particularly in Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, really direct their foreign policy and their foreign aid to a significant degree in combating public health threats in the poor countries of the world. Right now, the HIV epidemic, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, is probably the greatest public health calamity the world has seen since the Black Death 700 years ago. And not even a large fraction of the money we spend on our military could really make a significant dent in helping combat the HIV epidemic and in addressing other public health problems. Do you question the whole orientation of our foreign policy, and do you think maybe directing it toward public health might actually improve the goodwill and toward the United States and the world?
If the United States and other countries of the world want to protect the world from terrorism, they've got to begin to solve some of the problems that underlie the issue of terrorism in the world. Will that stop all terrorist acts? Of course it won't. But will it cut down on the number of people who are willing to be suicide bombers? Will it cut down on the number of people who are willing to use violent action rather than other forms of conflict resolution? There's no question that it will. And the number of problems that the United States could work to solve and have the resources necessary to solve, including not only AIDS that you've talked about, but a number of diseases around the world, including malaria and tuberculosis and unsafe water supplies, and a whole series of things that the United States could become a hero to the people of the world.
Well, Dr. Seidel, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
And my pleasure.
Well, that's it for today's show. Join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.